Hi, good evening. It's February 26th. I'm here in Jerusalem and recording the call. I don't have anybody else on the line right now, but I'm going to record anyway so that those who listen by recording will be able to hear the shiur tonight. This is the 16th shiur, and I want to start with reading some questions that I got from online from people who called in. And I very much welcome your questions by email, so I encourage you to send them, please. All right, so here's the first question. It's a question that has to do with souls having equal access to Hashem. She writes, I'm not clear on what that means. That means that if soul A and soul B both fulfill their potential, they're both equally as close to Hashem, even if one is objectively much holier than the other? Practically, does that mean that a soul that fulfills its potential can be as close to Hashem as Moshe, even though that soul isn't as great as Moshe? Also, she wonders about male and female souls. I know the usual different but equal approach, but how do we know that one is not, in fact, greater than the other? Okay, so I want to address this question here. So when I said that souls have equal access to Hashem, I mean that their ability to create a relationship is equal from the time that they're created. So that doesn't mean that they have the same pathway. There is a separate but equal approach, and that's not necessarily masculine and feminine, although it may be there too. But in terms of each individual person, that's the case. We are created in the image of Hashem, and one of the images of Hashem is the fact that we are all unique. There's nothing like Hashem anywhere in Zulato, and there's nothing like any of us either. We are all 100% completely unique. There has never been the convergence of the exact ingredients that's in any one of us ever before in history, nor could there ever be again in the future. The way that everything converges in us is completely unique. And when I say everything, I mean, the parenting that we experienced, the century that we're born into, even the decade these days as time moves so quickly, the decade that we were born into, the city in which we live, the spouse that we have or lack, the children that we have or lack, whatever it is, our learning abilities, disabilities, our looks, our money, our figure, our health. Nobody has exactly what we have. Nobody ever could and nobody ever will. It all converges exactly equally in each one of us. So our body reflects our soul. Our body, each person's body and circumstances, is the exact best pathway for that person's soul's best expression. So just like our bodies are completely separate, our bodies and our circumstances are completely unique, one from another, so too is each soul that's placed within us. Our body and our circumstances gives that soul pathways for expression. But each soul is completely 100% unique. So that the access that it has is equal access to Hashem. But how it accomplishes the relationship with Hashem, that is also unique, but not necessarily equal. Meaning, in potential, each soul has absolutely equal access. But after the potential has been realized or not realized, each soul then has accomplished something different. So at the end of a lifetime, it's a different concept than at the beginning. So the beginning of a lifetime, each soul has equal access. The end of a lifetime, the reason why we're not into death, unlike the Arabs, who are very excited to die because they see that as a pathway to their relationship with Hashem. We don't see that. We see life as our pathway and death as the end of potential. So we want to be alive as long as possible because as long as we're alive, we still have the potential to grow, and create more of a relationship. Once we die, however, the relationship that we want to create has been created. That's why Shabbos parallels this world. That's why Shabbos is Me'ein Olam Haba. What Olam Haba is about is dwelling in, not creating. Shabbos is about living in, not creating. It's behaving as if it's all done. That's what Shabbos is. That's the way that we behave. We don't exert any creative influence on our environment because we are practicing for Olam Haba, where we can't do anything to create. We just live in what we've already created. So that's why you have Sheshet Yamim Ta'aseh Melachtecha V'Yom HaShvi'i LaLakecha. 6 days we are working towards, and 1 day we live in. And that's practice for Olam Haba. This world we work towards, and that world we live in. So at the end of our lives, after we cross the divide, after candle lighting, so to speak, when our neshamas cross into the Shabbos zone, eternal Shabbos zone, so then our neshama has already created the relationship that it's going to live in. And at that point, when the potential has been realized, or however much of the potential a person has been realized, that's when there is a strong difference between one soul and another and what they've accomplished. So accomplishment is not the same, but potential access is the same at the beginning of a lifetime. So accomplishment at the end is what dictates how much of a relationship one will have with Hashem. So in her question, does that mean that if soul A and soul B both fulfill their potential, they're both equally as close to Hashem? The answer to that is yes, if they could be equal, but nothing's exactly equal, but yes. Theoretically, soul A and soul B fulfilling their potential would be equally close to Hashem. However, the second half of the sentence, even if one is objectively much holier than the other, so there, what is objective holiness? So I'm not going to claim here to be an expert on this. We're going to have to continue learning. So I don't know what objective holiness is or if holiness actually exists on the soul level. I did discuss this with the Rav, and he brought up that specific point. What is holiness in the realm of the soul? Holiness has to do with physicality, although we do say Kadosh Hashem, but that's in separate. So the idea of our souls working towards a relationship with Hashem is Dvekut, so that's blending, it's not separation. So it's in this world that we're supposed to be Kadoshim, holy, and in the next world we're supposed to be blended, connected in. So holiness is maybe a word that can't be applied necessarily to a soul. However, rather than using Duke in the language of the letter, let me move into what I think she's actually asking, even though it says holier. So I think the question is, let's say somebody has a potential of 10 measures, right? And somebody else has a potential of 12 measures, and they both fulfill their potential. So then one's fulfilled 12 and one's fulfilled 10. Do they have equal relationships with Hashem? So from what I understand at this point in my development of learning Hashkafa and from checking with some others, it seems like you can't measure like that. It's not like there's 10 measures or 12 measures. It's that we all have tremendous and actually unlimited potential. The more that we accomplish, the more potential we release. So the more we can grow, the more we'll be able to grow. And the more we use that in growth, the more we'll be able to grow. We'll see that as we go into the second question that I received. So just hold that for a minute as a thought and understand that as we grow, we increase our potential and that there's not, the potential that we are born with is not static, meaning it doesn't stay the same and we fill up the vase, let's say. It's not like we're each born like an empty container and when we fill up the container, we've achieved our potential and done. That's not the case. The more potential we achieve, the greater the container is, the higher the bar goes. We can achieve even more and even more and even more. I think I mentioned this one, speaking with one person who distressingly referred to this as never being able to catch the bus. She felt like she was constantly running in the dust and she was never able to catch up, catch the bus and sit down. And that's exactly the point, is that the further we go, the more we have to go. The more we achieve, the more we can achieve. This world is not about stopping. It's not about achieving and being done. It's about keep going and keep going and keep going and keep going. And the more we go, the more we increase, the more we increase, the more ability we have. And we continue and continue and continue, not stopping, so that we can continue to achieve more. So there's not a static amount of potential that one has. it continues to grow. And once we cross into the other world, that's when our potential is over and what we've accomplished is now present. So that's where the difference is in a person, is what they actually accomplished from what they were able to accomplish. Let's see, practically, does that mean that a soul that fulfills its potential can be as close to Hashem as Moshe, even though it isn't as great as Moshe? Oh, so what is as great as Moshe? We have the concept of great as Moshe, not that he's the most fabulous human being that ever lived. He was the most unav human being, and he was the greatest Navi. And there's no Navi that will ever achieve his level. And we are going to learn more about Nevuah as we continue on in the book. Nevuah is a very important concept, and we'll develop that as we go on. So you're going to have to leave that by the side a little bit. But Nevuah, in its essence, in its deepest root, is a connection to Hashem. What we think about is Nevi'im and Nevuah, the ability to channel Hashem's Ratzon into the world through language, to use a vision, or however Hashem chooses to communicate his Ratzon to the Navi, which we'll see when we continue on, when we discuss Nevuah. Whatever derech that is, the Navi is basically a channel. It creates a tzinur in himself where Hashem can reveal his will in some type of a way, and then the Navi is able to express it. So we think about the Navi expressor, the one that's able to express Hashem's will. But really in its deepest root, the Navi is the one who's able to receive it. Had to have that connection with Hashem that they're able to receive the concept of Hashem's Ratzon. So, but it's just that the Nevi'im that we have recorded, so those that we have experience with, we here living in 5772, have experience with, is the Nevi'im that are written down. So there's only 24 books in the Torah, and some of those contain Nevuah, and those are the only Nevi'im that we've ever encountered in our lives. So when we think about Nevuah or Nevi'im, we're thinking about those books or those Nevi'im that have things to say. But in fact, there's a much greater pool of Nevi'im than we've encountered. And they didn't all write books. They weren't all authors. There were millions of Nevi'im. There were Navi schools throughout Yerushalayim, throughout Eretz Yisrael, schools of Nevuah. And the schools were not so that people would be able to bring Hashem's message to the world, but so that people, individual human beings, could connect with Hashem on the deepest level where they could tap into that level of Ratzon Hashem themselves, whether or not they expressed it. So while Moshe was the greatest Navi that ever lived, it doesn't mean he's the greatest Jew or the greatest human. That's not the case. So each person has the potential in front of them that they are able to accomplish, and they can grow that potential. So theoretically, somebody could grow greater than that. Anybody can be as close to Hashem as they choose to be. It's all about the choices that we make. So, and each choice that we make increases our potential. So there is no comparison among souls until the potential has been accomplished. Once a person dies, so then they've achieved what they're going to achieve. It's actually not even quite at death, because their influence continues to ripple through the world. So it's really at the end of the world, but their influence and their soul capacity has reached its limit is when the world is over. But meanwhile, we do have one stopping point, and that's at death. And the second stopping point is when the world is over. So at death, that's when we've finished doing what we can do proactively to accomplish our relationship. However, we have set things into motion, sort of like setting a Shabbos clock before Shabbos that will turn something on Shabbos. And one reason why, and of course, depending on different halachas, one reason why that's mutter is we do have the reality, or the fact that that's mutter does point to the reality that it is possible to set up something before Shabbos that will function on Shabbos. So we have that reality spiritually as well, that it's possible for us to set up things in this world that will still influence our souls in the next world. So, for instance, teaching Torah or teaching good mitzvos or giving tzedakah that will make a difference. Let's say establishing a school or a yeshiva where people will continue learning. So if one merits to be able to do that, then they've set basically a Shabbos clock for continued spiritual growth in the next world. even when they can't touch it any longer, they still experience the growth that comes from what they set up earlier. Okay, so whoever wrote in that question, please feel free to continue asking about it if you didn't clearly understand it. Oh, well, then let me address the second part first before I turn the page over and answer the second question. All right, now the question is also about male and female souls. I know the usual difference but equal approach, but how do we know that one is not, in fact, greater than the other? Okay, so how do we know that male souls and female souls, one is not greater than the other? We certainly have a lot of controversy about this, and we certainly see that in this world, men seem to have more potential than women. It's interesting to think about. He has more mitzvot, right? So he has more pathways of connection, right? That's how we define the mitzvah initially. Is a physical pathway to a spiritual goal. So a man, if he has more mitzvot than a woman has, then he has more physical pathways to accomplish spiritual growth. How is she going to accomplish something similar? And that's one of the reasons that he said, Shelo Asani Isha, that he's thankful for that, is that he has more tools to work with than a woman has to work with. That being said, and what we usually say as Makarvot, when we're trying to explain things to people or has been explained to us, she starts out closer to Hashem. Sha'asani kirtzono. A woman is created kirtzon Hashem, so she's created closer. A man comes into a world and he needs a tikkun right away. Right away he needs bris milah. He needs something. He's born into the world with something that needs to be fixed right away. And women are born into the world much more, much closer to the way Hashem actually wants us to be. Okay, so maybe we start out closer and they have to work harder to get closer, which is why they have more tools. But as we've been seeing in Derech Hashem, it seems that it's all about the work. It's not that we want to start out closer. It's that we want to actually put in more effort. The more effort we put in, the closer we get. Lasum Sara Agra, right? According to the effort is the reward. So the more effort we put into it, the more reward we get. It's not just reward. We're not looking for agra, really. Not looking for, that's the root of the word agora. Back in the olden days, if you spent any time in Israel, they had agarot. I guess it's still called agarot, right? The parts of a shekel. So that's the small part from agra. It's a Greek word, actually. But anyway, it's not that we're looking for that, like, a reward in terms of pay, but we're actually looking for the reward of the closeness with Hashem. The more effort we put into it, the closer to Hashem we get. And that's part of the concept of Amelis B'Torah, why it's so hard to learn Torah, and why we have to put the effort into the pilpul and in the oral law, is because it's the Dafka L'Sum Sara Agra. The more effort we put in, the more difficult it is, the more reward is generated, the more relationship is created. So that being said, we would like to see that women also have the opportunity to work hard. So it seems that men and women, both, the more they work, the more potential they create. They have potential, and they continue to create it through the choices that they make. The more choices that they make, the more they develop themselves. The more they develop themselves, the greater potential they create for themselves. As they're creating their relationship, it creates reciprocally greater potential for greater relationships. The stronger relationship one builds, the more potential one creates for building a stronger relationship. And it keeps going back and forth. Bigger relationship, bigger potential, more capacity for relationship. More choices that build stronger relationship, more potential for even more. So either which way, they both start, they come from different starting places, but each one gets to create as much relationship as they possibly choose to create. Okay, so now let's look at the other question that was sent, because that really feeds into this. So here's the question. I've been thinking about the concept some more, the four stages that relate to the four letters of Hashem's name, and I have some additional questions. Could it relate to inspiration such that, one, we receive inspiration, two, we expand to think or plan how I can apply it to my life. Three, we work to apply the inspiration to my life. And four, transcendence when the work is done. So I'm really happy to see that people are thinking, actually taking the class and thinking about how it applies and how it works. But I just want to give a little tweak to this because it's close, That's not quite right. So here are the four levels again, and how, and we ask also how they relate to the Shem Hashem, the four letters of Hashem's name. We'll look at that second. Here are the four levels that we discussed last time. Whenever we discussed it, the four levels of growth, the male, female, that relates to Yod and He and Vav and He. So level one, the male, is receiving inspiration. Number two is to expand, think about that inspiration. Expand to think how it might be applied. Number three is to plan how to apply it. So that's a different number three than she wrote. She wrote, work to apply the inspiration to my life. And number three, I would phrase better, would be plan how to apply it. And I'm going to give this, I'll make a practical example in just a minute. Number four is to do it, to actually, really what she said in number three. Number four is to work to apply the inspiration to one's life. And where four is not transcendence, four is the actual doing, the actual integrating it into one's life. But the stage that comes after that is not number five, because we only have four steps here, but the stage after that is the synergy, the transcendence, is actually accomplishing what it is. Let's look at this in a practical application, right? So number one, that masculine level of receiving inspiration. Let's say one receives inspiration, just floats into their head, I want to know more. I want to know more Torah, right? That's the inspiration. They're inspired to learn. Okay, so now from the I want to know more, that instant inspiration, that desire, now it becomes expanded. What do I want to know more? What do I want to know more about? So I'm going to expand to think how. So in this example, let's say I want to know more Chumash and more Machshava. And Chumash, how do I want to know more Chumash? Well, I would for sure like to know, you know, start to finish, the whole storyline and how that works. And then I would like to actually know Rashi, you know, like all the Rashis on Chumash and what they mean. And I wouldn't mind actually also knowing Rav Hirsch. So Rav Hirsch and his explanations on Chumash. So you're expanding it further from I want to know more to what do I want to know? Chumash. What kind of Chumash storyline? Rashi, Hirsch. And Machshava. What kind of Machshava would I like to know? I'd like to be pretty fluent in general Jewish Machshava. How will I make that specific? I think I would really like to have a handle on what the Ramchal writes and thinks. And the Rambam, how he writes and thinks. And it'd be nice to know the differences so that when I encounter an idea, I know if this is a more of a Maimonidean idea or a Ramchal type of idea, where the differences are, where the similarities are. I would like to know that. Okay, that's number two, expanding the initial inspiration. But number three is now the planning. Okay, I want to know more. How am I going to make that happen? Let me look at my schedule. Let me think about my life and what works for me. Okay, so I'm going to plan 30 minutes of learning 5 times a week. I think I can accomplish that. That seems reasonable. You might even make a plan earlier. But stages three and four, you'll probably go back and forth a little bit with. Let's just start with a plan, right? So plan, 30 minutes, 5 times a week of straight learning from a text. One shiur a week that I attend, so a live shiur, and one recording a week that I listen to a shiur where I don't have an opportunity to answer, to ask questions, but I can hear a recording online or however I hear a recording. And also, I want to make sure that I get to shul in time on Shabbos for laning, so I get to hear the laning. So that's my plan, to increase my knowledge of Chumash and Machshava, 30 minutes, 5 times a week, one shiur live, one shiur by recording and hearing the laning. Now comes level four, actually doing it. So that means actually physically arranging my schedule, sitting down, really learning, making sure it's 5 times a week, checking it off, finding the shiur that I want to go to, winnowing which of the shiur that are available are the ones that I actually want to attend, finding the recordings, listening to the recordings, making sure I arrange my Shabbos morning so that I get to shul on time to hear the leaning. So there's a lot to do, and I may have to revise my plan. I may have to go back up to step three and revise the plan. Maybe I can expand it. Maybe I need to contract it. But meanwhile, I need to work on that. After years of doing that, sometimes it's shorter, sometimes it's longer, depending on what the plan is, but eventually I'm going to get to transcendence, where transformation has occurred because of the previous four steps. I'm going to know that transcendence has happened because I know more, right? Once I get to a place where I know more, I know that the desire to know more has been translated into a new me, a me that has more knowledge integrated into me. Now, clearly, this is a process that can continue and continue, and this is a great example also of how it works. Okay, just a second. So this is a great example also of how it works, that the more we increase ourselves, the more we can be increased. So the more we develop ourselves, the more we can be developed. So just in thinking about learning Torah, right, we have the desire to learn more, to know more, but once we've come to the place where we do know more, we actually then at that point know how much more there is to learn, or at least we have insight into how much more there is to learn, and we've also increased our capacity to learn it. So we've hopefully increased our desire to learn it and also our capacity to learn it. So we start back up at the top. I want to know more. What do I want to know more about? Well, now that I've learned Rashi and Hirsch, I've realized that I'd actually like to see the Ramban on the Chumash too, and maybe delve into some other areas. So how do I want to increase and how do I want to learn more? The more I learn, the more I have the capacity to learn. The more I add that in, the more I grow. And it's a back and forth process. So I hope that helps with that. Okay, so now she asks, why is this idea, what is the idea, as to why it correlates with the four letters of Hashem's name? So we want to first understand that Hashem chooses to relate to us in the masculine energy for the most part. Of course, Hashem has no masculine and has no feminine. But he does relate to us in masculine and feminine ways. So the reason why that we looked at some of this is to actually understand some of the masculine energy and the feminine energy, the masculine energy being the yud and the vav, step one and step three, the causative parts, receiving the inspiration and planning, the actual causing of the work that's going to be done is the plan. And then the feminine is the expansion, the creation of more from the inspiration that comes. So that would be level two and level four. So we have the level one, receive inspiration, level two, expand to think how that might work, and cause it back to level three, planning it, and then receiving it, receiving the plan, actually making it manifest in one's life is the doing of it. All of that adds up to transcendence. It relates to Shem Hashem because we want to understand that Hashem is an integrated whole, and yet we are created in Hashem's image. So if we can detangle a little bit of the way that Hashem works in the world, we can shed light on how we can work in the world. The fact that we're created in Hashem's image means that the more we understand ourselves, the more we can understand Hashem. And the more we understand Hashem, the more we can have insight into ourselves. And so there is a process that goes back and forth of reciprocity of understanding Hashem, leading to understanding of self, leading to understanding of Hashem. So for that reason, we want to look at the names that Hashem has given us to understand Him through. So the name that one of the names that He gave us is the name of Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei. And we understand on some level that the shame depicts Masha Sham. Of course, we don't give names to Hashem. Hashem gave the names Himself, unlike human beings or Adam who named the creatures of the world. Hashem revealed His name to us rather than us choosing a name for Him. Nevertheless, the name does depict something. So we do look at the Shemot Hashem in order to understand different aspects of Hashem and how Hashem functions. Again, we can only look with human eyes and human intellect and through our narrow vision try to understand something about Hashem. But we have to understand that we're only seeing one little slice, so to speak, one little glimpse. And Hashem is, of course, much bigger than that. But really, Hashem has given us the ability to look from this side and look from that side. And then He also gave us the capacity inside of us to try to be able to integrate all that information into a whole and then expand that out so that we could get some type of a glimpse into the essence of Hashem and also know that we didn't actually get a glimpse at all. Nevertheless, we do understand that in general Hashem relates to us in the masculine energy, the energy of giving and the energy of causing. So Hashem runs the world and Hashem grants us gifts. And those gifts are what we have to work with. We are the feminine then. We receive, whether we're male or female, we behave in the feminine. We receive what Hashem has given to us. And then we expand upon it so that we can accomplish what Hashem wants to accomplish. Even though Hashem runs the world and eventually is going to bring everything to a particular destination, He still wants us to be the ones who chart the course to that destination. So Hashem has moved Himself out of the way so that our free will be the one that determines, will be the mechanism that determines how that destination will be achieved. Okay, if that wasn't enough of an explanation, please ask more. Meanwhile, let's get to our text. Okay, we are holding in section 2, chapter 2, paragraph 2 of Derech Hashem. When I told somebody where we are in the book, I realized we're 2:22. So it just put me in mind of the word bracha, and I wanted to bring that in. I was privileged while I'm in Israel right now to spend some time with a friend of mine named Bracha. And Bracha is 2:22. It's the root of the word Bracha. It's Bet Resh Chaf. Bet is 2. Resh is 200. Chaf is 20. So each one of those letters is the first multiple in its category. It's the 2:22, and it's from the twos, from the multiplicity, that everything flows. Like a bricha, a pool flows, related to bracha, flowing. So I was just wondering, can we see bracha in this 2:22? Who knows if the Ramchal was considering that in this place. I'm not going to assume that, but I was looking at what bracha we might see, what flow we might see from this section. Okay, I'm going to actually go back first to paragraph 1. And just read that to set us up for paragraph 2. So paragraph 1. We've stated earlier that the purpose of the creation of the human species is that man should become worthy of attaining true good, namely being drawn close to him in the world to come. Hence, the ultimate end of all his evolvement is the tranquility in the world to come. The highest wisdom decreed, however, that this would be best attained if man would first exist in the present world, bound and limited by its natural laws. This is actually the true and proper preparation necessary for the desired goal, and everything in this world is therefore arranged so that it should serve as a means of preparing and readying man for this ultimate purpose. So I think we discussed earlier, or many of you have heard, that the word ared, this earth, could be a root. I will run. I'm constantly in motion. And Shemayim, heaven, heavens, or the next world, our destination, is Sham, the root of Sham, Shamayim Sham, Shamness, there, or dwelling. So this is the world of working, and that is the world of dwelling. So Sham arranged two separate levels, where we work towards, and then we live within. And so that's what we're working towards. That's paragraph 1, is that there is a preparation necessary. Hashem says the world that preparation would be able to happen. And then the next world is where we live in whatever we created through that phase of preparation. Okay, now to 2:22, let's see bracha and this, Be'ezrat Hashem. This preparation involves two aspects, one concerning individuals and the other humanity as a whole. The preparation of the individual is his attainment of perfection through his deeds. That of humanity as a whole involves the preparation of the entire human race for the world to come. Man is created with a good urge and an evil urge, a yitzhatov and a yitzhara, and free will. This then allows the human race to include some individuals who are good, as well as others who are evil. Ultimately, the evil ones must be cast aside and the good ones gathered to form one perfected community. It is for this community that the future world and all its attained good are intended. Okay, so let's just review, look at that for a minute, examine it. So we've regularly said that mankind, or a Jew, we have a dual mission, and that is to perfect ourselves and to perfect the world. So the preparation, he's saying here, has two aspects, one concerning individuals and the other humanity as a whole. So each individual has the capacity to work on themselves, but it's not enough. Really, Hashem wants to reveal himself to the entire world. And so we say, V'yom ha'hu yeh Hashem achad u'shmo achad. On that day, Hashem will be one, and his name will be one for everyone, not just for Jews, and not just for a certain group of Jews. But whatever our differences and our different points of view, it's all going to be united in the true essence. Once we all get it, once we all see it, yeh Hashem achad u'shmo achad. Of course, again, Hashem is already one. But our perception of Hashem will be already one. U'shem achad, then what's the difference? If Hashem achad u'shmo achad, why do we say Hashem achad as separate from shmo achad? His name is one. So we do talk about the name expressing some type of essence of Hashem. So we're not going to call Hashem not just the concept that we'll all perceive Hashem in the truth of Hashem, but it'll be such a clear perception that there'll only be that one name to call Hashem. We'll get it. We'll all see it. We'll all understand it. It will click so well that his name will be one. His essence will be understood by us. Of course, not fully. We're still human beings, still limited. We can't fully wrap our minds around the infinite. Nevertheless, we will understand enough to be able to have one name that expresses an essence of Hashem that we are able to understand. That's for all of humanity, humanity as a whole. So the entire human race needs to be prepared for the world to come. Mashiach also is not coming to any individual or any individual group, but rather to the entire world. So, but that's as we prepare for the world to come. That is what allows Mashiach to enter in, is the place that we create. Mashiach is going to come whether we create the appropriate environment or not, because Hashem is going to lead the world that way, and Hashem does transform things to get his will done. That's something I heard Rabbi Yitzchak Berkowitz speak last night, and he said, you know, look at the Megillah. A message from the Megillah is that Hashem runs the world, right? So everybody's clear on that. But what does it mean? So he said everything, people do what they choose to do. He allows our free will to happen, but he doesn't always allow our intended results to happen. So we get to pick what we do. We certainly don't get to pick the results. We get to plan what we think the results might be. We get to aim towards those results with what we do. But what the results actually are is what Hashem chooses for them to be. So, for instance, we have the tragedy, the opening tragedy of the Megillah, where a very nice Yaakov girl, so to speak, Esther, is kidnapped, the wife of the Gadol Hador, kidnapped and brought into the palace and forced into a relationship with the king, non-Jewish king. It's a terrible thing. And yet, Hashem, rather than her just being the beautiful queen in the palace, Hashem was arranging for there to be the right person on the inside at the right time. Then Haman makes the gallows to hang Mordechai. For sure he intended to hang the Gadol Hador. There's no question about that. But that's not how the gallows were to be used. Even though he intended it, and even though he invested his actions in that direction, Hashem is the one who chose the result. There was a decree to kill the Jews. Right, but that decree to kill the Jews allowed there then to be a decree to kill the anti-Semites. So Rabbi Berkowitz explained that there never would have been the law in Persia that you can't rescind a decree. There never would have been a proactive decree to kill all the anti-Semites had there not been a decree to kill the Jews. We Jews are not about holy war. We don't have jihad concepts where we go out and kill those who are against us, not on a regular basis, certainly. And it requires a special commandment for the few wars that we have gone out like that. It requires a special and specific commandment for that time. In this case, the king commanded that the anti-Semites be killed as a counter to the decree that the Jews be killed. So what looked like a terrible tragedy ended up being good for the Jews in that the anti-Semites were able to be eliminated from society. So there's many examples within the Megillah where people did things and their intention was one way. Think about, what is her name, the daughter of Haman. I don't think her name is there, but the wife of Haman. Anyway, the daughter of Haman, who thought to herself, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to humiliate Mordechai. He's leading my father on the horse, and I'm going to specifically humiliate him. And so she poured a bucket of waste on his head, and then she realized that it was her father. But she intended to humiliate one, and instead she humiliated another. So our intentions and our actions, not always our actions, always our intentions, and often our actions are up to us. But the results are not. Hashem runs the world. And so in it, he will bring Mashiach, and the world will come into an expected place. Things will come out the way Hashem wants them to. He does want that to happen through us. So we set up the world where we can make choices and we can bring it about. So the pathway is through us. But the ultimate destination is what Hashem has already chosen. Okay, and it is for the entire human race that that the end will be for, and everybody gets to choose if they want to be part of that perfected community or not. No individual is born with their future chosen for them. Every individual can choose if they want to be part of the end design or not. It's completely up to them. They get to choose their behavior, which will choose them into or out of goodness or evil, into or out of the end of the perfected community or not, the future world or not, Olam Haba or not, up to each individual. Okay, let's go to... I'm just going to go to the first paragraph of paragraph 3 because it's a very long thing here, and I just want to give you something to think about for the coming week. It is the principle of free will that assures the possibility of good and evil in the human race, allowing some of its members to be good and others to be evil. This same principle, moreover, also has the same consequence with respect to the deeds of each individual. Although a person's deeds may be either all good or all evil, it is also possible that some be good and others evil. Okay, so let's just look at that for a minute. So we have the entire human race that's filled with individuals. Individuals can choose if they want to be a good individual or an evil individual. Then we have an entire human being that's filled with deeds. And each deed is either good or evil. So you could have a human race with both good and evil individuals in it. You can have a human being with both good and evil deeds in it, or in that person. So in a way, there's a parallel in that there is the one whole, and according to the choice of the constituent part, there can be good and evil parts. So humanity as a whole can have good and evil people in it, and a person can have good and evil deeds in them. So it's not that each person, a person could be all good or all evil in theory. However, we know that practically it's not possible. In Tzaddik Asher Lo Yechta, in Tzaddik Be'ar Asher Lo Yechta, there's no such thing as a Tzaddik that didn't sin. And there's also, conversely, no such thing as a Rasha that didn't do some kind of good. So we know that in practice it's not possible for a person to be all good or all evil. Everybody has some sort of general trend and then an admixture of the other. But in terms of humanity, we do have all humanity will be brought to the constructed place, and only the good of humanity will end up as the group. But each person gets the two. So currently we do have the mixture of good and evil in one. Let's just end on this thought right now, because we're going to go into the judging of the good and the evil and how that's judged as we continue in this text, which is not where I want to go right this very minute. I just want to end with the concept of free will. It's just interesting to note, and I haven't read it yet, but I saw that Sam Harris just published a new book. Excuse me, Sam Harris is one of the primary proactive atheists on the planet. He's written quite a few books to try to get people away from religion of any type. And he realizes that one of the problems of getting people away from religion is that there isn't really a source of morality without religion. So his last book is called The Moral Landscape, where he tries to establish a science-based morality, a morality based on scientific principles. And this new book, he still has a problem with that. There's still one of the problems of having no religion is that where does free will come from? And how does free will operate? So his new book is called Free Will, and he kind of, in his book, that there is no such thing as free will. And he backs it up with whatever science he's able to find that backs it up, but he wants to say there is no such thing as free will. So that is so central to human society and the way that we think and breathe in this world, all human beings, the concept of free will. Not everybody understands it well or is able to use it well. The concept that there is the concept that underlies our jurisprudence systems in all countries, the fact that we can choose. We don't punish people for who they are, but rather for what they chose to do. I stopped myself just because I was thinking about, let's say, in the Salem witch trials. So there were people who were, quote-unquote, discovered to be witches and based on biblical verses, killed for who they are, not for what they did. I don't know if it had to be proved that they actually practiced witchcraft. And certainly we have instances in the Arab world where homosexuals are persecuted for who they are, not necessarily what they did. I don't know if one has to be actually caught in the act, but rather just found to be, and I'm not positive about this, in order to be persecuted in those worlds. Nevertheless, most justice systems or systems that have actual justice are predicated on the fact that the person in question had a choice, which is why we, for instance, have an insanity defense if somebody is mentally ill or insane and can prove that that's why they did what they did. You know, let's say, I don't know, somebody low-level, I'm trying to think of an example that's not terrible. Let's make it easier then. Let's say somebody stole, right? They broke into where the crown jewels are in England and took all the crown jewels because they were actually so mentally unstable that they believed that they're the king of England and those are actually their possessions. So they didn't, in their mind, they weren't stealing at all. They're just taking what belonged to them already and wearing them. So it would be hard to punish somebody if you could really find that that's true, that the person stole thinking it's theirs, that what we view as stealing, they were mentally unstable enough to view as just taking what actually belongs to them. We don't punish for theft for that. We may want to lock the person up because we want to protect ourselves from that person, but we don't punish for theft because there wasn't a choice of transgression in that act, and that's what we punish for. So a principle of Jewish philosophy, a foundation of everything, is that we have free will, that we absolutely can choose what to do. And it's through that we receive reward and punishment. There can be no reward, and there can be no punishment for something that we didn't make a choice about. I'll tell you a story. I hope I didn't tell this earlier, but I one time had beautiful antique bedspreads that my great-great-grandmother had crocheted, and I put it on an antique bed that we had in a room. It was also my great-great-grandmother's bed.
it was just my one great grandmother that crocheted. Anyway, had this antique crochet bedspread on a bed. And my 5-year-old took a pair of fingernail scissors and cut a hole in it. And he knew that he was doing something naughty. He knew that it was a bedspread and that he shouldn't cut it. So I yelled at him, but I knew that he didn't know what he did. He didn't know that it was a 100-year-old family heirloom that he destroyed. So I had to yell at him for destroying something on purpose that he knew he shouldn't have destroyed, but I couldn't yell at him with full force of how I was feeling because he didn't know what he destroyed. He just knew that he destroyed something he shouldn't have, but he didn't know how important that thing was. So I could only yell partially for my own self. I had to yell again the second day just because I hadn't yelled enough because he destroyed something so precious to me. But that particular child, I'll just tell you this story, that particular child was not a human child. So the second day when I was yelling at him, I said, "Do you understand why I'm yelling at you?" And he looked at me and said, "Yes, I do, because you always yell at me." I said, "That's right." So Baruch Hashem, he's great now. He's grown up, has his own kids, and we have a fabulous relationship. It wasn't so easy raising him. Meanwhile, however, the point of this story is that while I was able to reprimand him because he knew that he shouldn't have destroyed, he didn't fully know what he was destroying. So the will, consciousness, and engagement with activity is really what one could be punished about or rewarded for. So somebody can't be punished all the way if they don't actually understand what they're doing. A 2-year-old who knocks over a Ming vase in somebody's house, it's not their fault at all. 2-year-olds run around, 2-year-olds throw things. They can't even be reprimanded for throwing yet. They can be trained to not throw, but they can't fully be reprimanded. They don't know yet that they shouldn't and what the results could be. So they're not to blame if something precious breaks. Really, the homeowner or the parent is more to blame for either putting the child in a place where they shouldn't have been or putting the object in the place where it shouldn't have been. So it really has to do with free will. So all that being said, and maybe we'll discuss free will more another time, I just want to point out that one of the messages in the book of Esther is how one uses one's free will. And we'll talk about that a little bit more next week. But this week, just to think about, how do you use your free will? How do you engage in this world? At what point do you have actual choice to choose your reaction to things, to choose your desires about things, to choose how you behave? You don't get to choose the result, but you do get to choose how you frame it, how you desire it, and the initial efforts that you make to accomplish it. So just be aware, have some heightened awareness of free will in your life and what that means, and we'll continue discussing it next week. Bezrat Hashem at our regular time. I'll be back in Denver, and we'll continue next week at our regular time, 7 p.m. Mountain Time, 9 p.m. New York time, and all the times that go with that in between. And please continue sending questions by email or chiming in on the phone or give me a call, and I'll be thrilled to answer them here on this recording. Thanks, and have a great week.